This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you live in a city, you've probably seen them living on the streets, dirty, disoriented, and arguing with invisible people. The mentally ill homeless are also winding up in America's jails and prisons, which are not equipped to deal with them. My guest, E. Fuller Torrey, has written a new book called Out of the Shadows, Confronting America's Mental Illness Crisis. Torrey is a research psychiatrist at the Neuroscience Center of the National Institute of Mental Health, and he's the author of the bestseller Surviving Schizophrenia. He's worked with the mentally ill at a state hospital and in homeless shelters. He thinks the crisis is partly an unintended consequence of deinstitutionalization, a movement in the 70s that changed the commitment laws and made it very difficult to institutionalize anyone against their will. I asked him if he supported deinstitutionalization back in the 70s.
All of us, Terry, agreed that the state mental hospitals were very unpleasant places back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and I became a psychiatrist actually in 1970, just as deinstitutionalization was really getting underway. And I think all of us in the profession said, look, we need to do something different. We have not treated these people very well in the hospitals. But then we made an equally large mistake, because what we did is the way we set up the financial parts of this is that we created a huge incentive for the states to empty out the hospitals. The states actually save money. They save state money by emptying people out of the hospital. They effectively shift the cost from the state to the federal government, SSI, Medicaid, etc. And yet there is no incentive to provide the treatment for the people once they leave the hospital. The state saves the money up front, so you have this huge carrot that's been set up and that the states have acted on, saying, we can save our state money by emptying people out. We can't save any more money by treating them. So de facto, they just emptied the hospitals. And that was a huge part of the mistake. A second part of the mistake was that we trained too many lawyers who don't know very much about mental illness. And these are especially the civil liberties lawyers, the Bazelon Center in Washington, the New York Civil Liberties Union. And what these young lawyers said is, the most important thing we can do is liberate the mentally ill. We will make it almost impossible to get them in the hospital. And if they get in the hospital, we'll make it very, very easy to get them out of the hospital. And that, in fact, is what happened. In combination with the liberal lawyers, you then had some conservative people in the state legislatures who said, if we close down the hospitals, we can save some money. So you had this funny coalition of far left and some far right that over 20 years emptied out the hospitals. And that was a terrible mistake.
Deinstitutionalization was in part a reaction to state hospitals that were just warehousing patients in very unpleasant conditions, and a reaction to involuntary commitment. Do you believe in involuntary commitment?
Oh, absolutely, Terry. And I think, again, that has been something that has been a kind of politically correct problem, is to say nobody should be treated involuntarily. Well, that's fine if you've got a brain that's working normally. I agree. No one should have a heart bypass who doesn't agree to it, etc. But you're dealing with a brain disease, and the brain disease, both schizophrenia and manic depressive illness, interfere with a person's ability to think. It's very much like Alzheimer's disease. And when we talk about Alzheimer's disease, we don't have any problem in saying someone who doesn't understand there's something wrong with their brain should be on a closed ward, shouldn't go outside in the snow without shoes and socks on, etc. And yet when you turn this from Alzheimer's disease to schizophrenia, we have enormous problems. And we say nobody should be treated involuntarily, so that you get people who are living on the streets in the major cities, who are defecating on the streets, who are unable to take care of themselves, who, if they're women, are being raped on a regular basis. We say, well, that's unfortunate, but that is their right. They have the right to live on the street, as if they're able to think clearly about their own needs. We know now from studies that about 50% of these people are unable to appreciate the fact that they're sick. They're unable to think about their own needs clearly.
Are there things that we know about mental illness now that we didn't know during the movement to deinstitutionalize patients?
Yeah, and I think that's a very important part of it. We look back now and say, how could we have made those mistakes? But in fact, in the 60s and the 70s, we didn't understand very much about the causes of these mental illnesses. There still were a lot of Freudian theories around, that, gee, there was nothing wrong with them except their mothers looked at them cross-eyed, or it's the stresses of society, these kinds of things. Those theories are now nonsense. We now know that diseases like schizophrenia, manic depressive illness, severe depression, these are brain diseases. We can show differences in the brain structure. We can show differences in the brain function. We now have overwhelming evidence that these are brain diseases exactly like, say, Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis or Alzheimer's disease. And therefore, we have to treat them as brain diseases. We cannot treat these people as someone where there's nothing wrong with them. They just have an alternate lifestyle. It's not an alternate lifestyle. It's a brain disease.
How effective do you think antipsychotic drugs are?
Antipsychotic drugs are remarkably effective. They're not without problems. They have side effects. As a whole, they are safer than the drugs we use for, say, something like rheumatoid arthritis. There are, say, maybe 15 to 20% of people who don't respond to the drugs we have now, and maybe another 10% where the side effects are so severe that you wonder whether it's worthwhile to take it. But at least two-thirds and probably three-quarters of people do respond to the antipsychotic drugs, do get much better, and in some cases become virtually symptom-free. But they certainly are able to then live in the community and lead a reasonably normal life, a much more reasonable life than when they're psychotic.
If you were writing the rules for who should be committed against their will, what would the rules be?
The rules would be, first of all, I would agree with someone like Mayor Koch in New York, who I thought had a lot of courage, especially within the politically correct culture of New York, to say, look, anyone who appears to be clearly disabled and living on the streets, we legally have the right to pick up and hospitalize for 30 days and treat to see if they respond to medications and to take a look at them. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to do. Now, if you hospitalize someone and treat them and they don't respond to medications or they can't take the medications because of the side effects and they are basically harmless, then fine. I'm willing to let that person live in the community in whatever way they want. But those people are relatively few and far between. If, on the other hand, the person tends to become violent or aggressive or dangerous when they're not treated, then I'm not willing to let that person live on the street. And I would hospitalize them involuntarily, and if they don't respond to medication, I would probably hospitalize them for a long period of time if they have a history of violent behavior. And that includes homicides, which are not rare.
What's the biggest thing that has changed in your thinking and how to deal with the mentally ill who are either pose a danger or who can't take care of themselves? How your thinking has changed since you started in the profession in the early 70s?
Oh, I think we were all a bit naive in the early 70s and thought that if we let people out of the hospital, a little like Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or the old movie King of Hearts, you know, you open up the doors and you let people out and they're going to live happily ever after. And it became...
They'll show us we're the crazy ones.
That's right, exactly. And it became very clear by the early 80s to many of us that this wasn't the scenario. These people weren't living happily ever after. Many of them ended up dead, suicide, or through illness, or through accidents, or whatever. The quality of life for people that we had released from the hospital and who were off their medications was really abysmal. The people I see in the clinic that I run for many years for homeless individuals, these are not quality lives. These are really living hell.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. E. Fuller Turi. He's a psychiatrist who's written extensively about schizophrenia. His new book is called Out of the Shadows, Confronting America's Mental Illness Crisis. And a lot of the book is about the mentally ill homeless. Do you think that health insurance and HMOs should cover mental illness more than they do? I mean, what do you think the standard should be?
I think that HMOs, health insurance, etc., should cover severe mental illness exactly the way they cover severe heart illness and severe liver illness and severe kidney illness. Now, where I would differ from some of my colleagues would have them cover everything under the sun and all kinds of unhappiness, and everyone who wants to go in and talk to their psychotherapist about why their third wife is divorcing them or why their teenager won't talk to them anymore. I would cover severe mental illness. I would cover brain disease. And that basically means schizophrenia, manic depressive illness, obsessive compulsive disorder, severe recurrent depression, and some of the severe childhood illnesses that have a brain disease base on it. I think those people should be covered in exactly the same way, and the HMOs in managed care is not doing so. These people need a lot of care. They need rehabilitation, like people with Parkinson's disease, like people with multiple sclerosis, and the HMOs, most of the HMOs, not all, and the managed care companies are geared to not provide this kind of care. These people are being lost between the cracks, and in fact, things are getting worse rather than better with managed care for the severely mentally ill.
Your area of expertise is brain disease. I wonder if you have any interest in or respect for psychotherapy. I think I detect a little condescension whenever the subject of psychotherapy comes up.
Yeah, you did detect a little condescension because psychotherapy has occupied, has taken a lot of the resources that should have gone for severe mental illnesses. I think anyone who wants to undergo psychotherapy and talk to their counselor about why their third wife is divorcing them or why they didn't get tenure or why they didn't get advancement or whatever, I think should be able to do so, but I think they should pay for it. I don't think it should be under medical insurance. I don't think it's a medical issue. I think it's an issue of learning about oneself. And I think anyone who wants to do this should be able to. But to take your medical resources and to take psychiatric resources and put them into unhappiness, I think has been a major mistake, and that's one of the points I emphasize in the book.
What do you do when you're walking down the street, not as a psychiatrist, but just as a pedestrian, and you run into someone who's mentally ill and homeless? Do you just ignore them or do anything?
Well, first of all, I take a look at them because this is an area I've been very interested in for many years. First of all, I see if I recognize them, as I do, and not rarely, as someone I've seen around the clinic or seen elsewhere on the streets on it. Secondly, I make the basic division, is this person a drug addict or an alcoholic, or are they severely mentally ill? The vast majority of people who are panhandling on the streets do not have schizophrenia or manic depressive illness. The vast majority of people who are holding out their hand for money are either alcoholics or drug addicts. And in most cases, I do not give them money. If I see someone who is severely mentally ill, and either because I know them from before or whatever, sometimes I will give them money. If I can be really helpful, I will try and direct them to either my clinic or one of the other clinics where they might be able to get some help. Because if they don't get medication, then things are not going to improve for them.
Do you have many patients who have families that would have liked to take care of them, but were just unable to because the patient wouldn't allow it?
Oh, yes. In many cases, the mentally ill person who is homeless has been completely lost track of by their family. And these are very sad. The family don't know if they're alive or well. And there's a very large number of people in this category. I see other people where the family doesn't understand their illness, has become disgusted with them. I saw one woman who, in fact, came from a middle-class family, and where the family didn't know where she was, and the daughter who was going to college literally stumbled over her mother, who was living on the floor of National Airport, as the daughter was going back to college. It's the first time the family knew where she was in 2 years. So there's all variations on this. In some cases, when you get the person on medications, they will then reestablish contact with their family. And in one case, I had a woman who, in fact, had been in a PhD program. We got her on medication, got her back to her home in the South, and she's now living in a group home very close to her home and doing much better. These are the few successes that we have.
Dr. E. Fuller Torrey is my guest. He's a psychiatrist and the author of several books about mental illness. His new book is called Out of the Shadows, Confronting America's Mental Illness Crisis. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with psychiatrist E. Fuller Torrey. His new book is called Out of the Shadows, Confronting America's Mental Illness Crisis. I know you have a sister who's schizophrenic. How old is she, and how bad is her illness?
She's in her mid-50s now, Terry. She was 17 when she developed schizophrenia. And schizophrenia is a disease that begins usually in the late teens and early 20s. She has a more severe form of the illness than the average person, especially for a woman. This is a disease where men tend to get it more severely than women do. But my sister, in fact, had a severe form and was hospitalized continuously for 25 years. And then was deinstitutionalized very, very typically. Because I know the system in New York State and because I can call up people and threaten them if they don't treat her properly, I'm able to get reasonably good care for her. And she's living in a group home now in upstate New York. She gets quite good care. She has a boyfriend. She is able to go out and shop. She's able to go out and go to restaurants with him. She's not able to live on her own, but the quality of her life is certainly much better. So in that sense, she is one of the successes of deinstitutionalization, although part of the reason is because I think that I'm able to threaten the system so that she does, in fact, get good care.
Did your sister always respond to antipsychotic drugs, or is it only newer drugs that she's been responsive to?
She has been responded relatively poorly to the antipsychotic drugs. She responds a little bit better to the newer medications, and we do have newer medications that are quite good. But still in her 50s, she is quite disabled much of the time. She is not one of these people who gets almost completely well on the medications. But that's also because she has a more severe form of the disease.
You know, I remember in the early 70s, the view of antipsychotic drugs was basically that there were drugs that sedated people and that the people lived like vegetables. Maybe they weren't hearing voices or acting up, but they were basically just sedated vegetables. Was that, do you think, a correct view or a misapprehension?
It was partially true, and that is because the antipsychotics that we used in the early 70s were more sedating. Thorazine, Melaril were good examples on that. At the same time, let me add that I think it was also falsely promoted by the people who said the hospitals ought to be emptied, especially some of the civil liberties lawyers, and more recently the Church of Scientology, which has a long history of attacking psychiatry, and they promote the idea that these are terrible drugs, that they basically cause lobotomies, that they damage the brain, that people are never the same. There was also a tendency then, and still is some, to mistake the symptoms of the disease for the side effects of the medication. In fact, if you went on the wards of the mental hospitals before we had any of these illnesses, before we had any of these drugs, you would see people who were sedated. You would see people who were vegetables on the basis of the side effects of the medications. So you have to differentiate the symptoms of the illness from the side effects of the medication. The bottom line is that the new medications have far fewer side effects, and especially in the way of sedation, that is not nearly as big a problem.
What advice do you have to families who have someone in the family who's mentally ill and who has basically left the family and is likely living in some distant city on the street, and the family has just been unable to keep track of the person?
This is a terrible problem, and I think that the family is faced with a dilemma. One is they can try and hospitalize the person involuntarily, and depending on the county and depending on the state and the laws, this may or may not be possible. And sometimes I encourage the family to do that. However, if that fails, then the person often will disappear and mistrust the family still more. The other thing I encourage the families to do is to use whatever leverage you have. We don't call it blackmail anymore, but that's what we used to call it. For example, there are often situations where the family is providing money or the family is paying the rent on the person's living situation, wherever they're living. And in some cases, I think it's perfectly valid for the family to say, look, John, we're willing to help you out, but we also want you to help yourself, so that our support on a monthly basis is going to depend on your going to the clinic and cooperating with the doctor and taking medication if it works. If, and that is often something that the the families do, and often is effective. There's lots of ways to do this. In my sister's case, for example, she takes her medicine because she knows that she'll end up back in the hospital very quickly if she doesn't. But something like cigarettes is very, very important to her. And she knows if she doesn't take her medicine, I'll no longer buy cigarettes for her. And in her case, that's enough to keep her going.
I wonder if you have any advice for those of us who often run into homeless mentally ill people on the street, and we're really not sure what to do, whether we should acknowledge them in some way, offer money, do something, or just kind of keep walking and stay out of trouble.
I think for someone who is homeless mentally ill with schizophrenia or manic depressive illness, for example, usually they will not ask you for money. And giving them money, not a lot of money, but giving them money, I think, is a humane thing to do in some cases. If you're aware of where the shelters are, if you're aware of where the soup kitchens are, directing them to that. I think the most important thing that people can do, and the reason I wrote the book, is to be aware that this is an ongoing disaster on the streets. This is a personal disaster for the literally 150,000, 200,000 people who are severely mentally ill people living on the streets. It's also a disaster in terms of the quality of life for those of us who live in the cities, those of us who feel very uncomfortable seeing people who are clearly disabled on the streets, so that the quality of life for all of us has deteriorated, and that this really shouldn't be. This is a failure of our system, and ultimately, the man in the street, the woman in the street, has to hold their public officials responsible for this. This is a public issue, and that's the most important point I can make.
Dr. Torrey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thanks for having me.
Dr. E. Fuller Torrey's new book is called Out of the Shadows, Confronting America's Mental Illness Crisis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.